Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
I mentioned on Sunday that the local Murfreesboro Post has also printed the article that ran 2 weeks ago in the Smyrna AM paper on Theology Matters. However, neither paper decided that my title was any good, and both of them decided to change the titles. Well, I got an email today from the Murfreesboro Post telling me that there has already been a discussion, you know, how you can log in and add comments to just about anything on the internet anymore. And of course, anytime you write a positive Christian article and put it anywhere on the internet, immediately the detractors and the atheists and the agnostics are going to leap right up there and make a comment instantly, because there's no one so brave as an anonymous person with a nickname behind a keyboard. And they can get right online and just start typing away. The first comment on the article online says, "To better understand the standard myth on which Christianity is based, watch this documentary if you care to learn the truth. And you can believe in cryptic documents written and revised during the Dark Ages by men with agendas, or hear the truth." So, of course, I went and, you know, looked at the little video, and it was real typical, the same old arguments we've all heard forever. It's just Mithraism in new clothes, without ever doing the historic research it takes to find out that the supposed parallels between some of these ancient mystic religions and Christianity don't actually exist. But if you just make these broad sweeping statements, then people who don't want to believe anyway have more foundation for their lack of belief and lack of research. So a person right behind them wrote in, this is on October 22nd, and said, well, the first person's name was Ellie, that was their nickname, said, "Ellie, anyone, and I mean anyone, can post stuff on YouTube. If anyone really cares to understand what the truth about Christianity is or what it's based on, read a history book. Not to say they aren't slanted either, but they do tend to be a bit more accurate than some fool on YouTube. If anyone really has an open mind, they'd question religion. They would ask, why is this or that the way you say it is? But when you start to ask questions, they'll try to shut you up, and that right there is the first sign that their argument is bogus." So then, okay, good answer there to Ellie. The third post says, "I would like to know Pastor McLarty's opinion of the Bible Park that's being proposed in Rutherford County. Does he feel this park will impart the important theological teachings which should be supplied by a church? And if Pastor McLarty is for or against the park, I'd like to hear his reasoning." Of course, my article had nothing to do with the park.
Is that what everybody has these signs that say, no theme park?
No theme park. Yes.
No neighborhood.
It's going to be a Bible theme park, apparently. But it's going to be on that big piece of farmland out there where so many folks bought homes and settled out there to be able to look out over, including you. Yeah, right.
We think it'll make a strong theological. We're going to actually make it our church.
Exactly. Yeah, but the entrance fee there is going to be much steeper than it is here, yeah. So I'm reading through these, and I'm just kind of chuckling at the different comments, and I come across this. "Ellie, you say, quote, 'to better understand the myth on which Christianity is based,' unquote. My question to you is, what are you basing your assumptions on? Have you ever cracked open the Bible under a solid teacher who understands the reasoning for the onset of the Reformation? A teacher who can articulate the Pauline doctrine of salvation by grace through faith in the 100% completed work of Christ? A teacher who can point out the distinctions between Israel and the New Covenant Gentile Church, hint they are not the same? A teacher who can start you out in Genesis and keep hammering at the basics like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? This is the key to understanding all the rest of Scripture, to my way of thinking, and it is just this that is not being taught in most of what is called Christianity today. It is, however, being rightly divided at GCA under Pastor Jim's leadership. And if you are in the area, I urge you to stop by." Now, I read this far into it, and I'm thinking, well, it's the Murfreesboro Post, and so somebody from Murfreesboro, probably someone from this congregation, has taken the time to write this comment. And whoever it was, I was pleased with your comment, and I was happy you wrote it. And then I read, I have gained immeasurably by his guiding hand. I live in Hamtramck, Michigan, by the way. I've never met Jim, but he's like my brother, like he lived in my own house for my whole life. And that, I can tell you, is the truth. Why don't you take a moment and check it out? Thanks. The Murfreesboro Post owes us for spreading their readership all the way to Hamtramck, Michigan. I had put a link to the article.
Who was it?
I don't know. I do not know. But, you know, we have listeners scattered all over the place.
Is that guy or any of them?
No, no, he's in Ohio.
And then the guy who drove through Michigan and stopped?
Which part of I don't know have you misunderstood? I mean, you can keep insisting that I know, but I don't care how many times you tell me that I know.
Did he leave his email address on the comment?
Yes.
You need to email him.
I did. Told him thank you very much. Told him that now I knew that I had a place to stay if I was ever stranded in Hamtramck. I know Hamtramck, Michigan. Played many weddings and bar mitzvahs and parties in Hamtramck, Michigan in my youth. Exodus 7 is where we're at tonight. Been working our way verse by verse through the book of Exodus, having made it all the way through Genesis, and we reach the point now where God is going to start pouring out plagues on Egypt. There's a great deal of underlying historical and theological importance to these plagues. And I'd be doing you a great disservice if we just read through it as simply a narrative. When you read it in chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, it reads like a narrative. It reads like a story. But there are also particular comments God makes and particular plagues that take place that the more you know about Egyptian history, the more you can understand why these particular plagues and why God poured them out in the order he did and the way that he did. Now, if you were to watch one of the like Ten Commandments movies, you get the impression that these plagues took place over the course of a couple of days, like Egypt had a bad weekend. But in reality, based on a few of the things that are stated, we know that these plagues started somewhere in the fall and that they end somewhere in the following spring. Now, we have a real good indication as to when they end. We know that Nisan the 14th is the day of the Passover. We know that that corresponds pretty much to our spring calendar somewhere in April. And so we know that that's the period when they leave Egypt. But some of the things that Moses is very clear to tell us about the destruction of the different crops and the crops that still remained tell us that the plagues of like the locusts happened somewhere in January. So then we know that the plagues that happened prior to that had to have been happening in the fall, building up to the January plagues. And so there's a fair amount of lexical information and historic information that tells us that this really took place over the course of several months. So get that idea of the bad weekend out of your head. God continually, over the course of time, kept sending Moses into Pharaoh and saying, let my people go so they can come out in the wilderness, a three-day journey, and that they can come out to worship me. And each time that Pharaoh said no, time passed. And then Moses would appear again in the court before Pharaoh, and then the next plague would take place. Now, this makes sense, too, when you think about the way the plagues play out. For instance, you're all, I'm sure, familiar with the fact that the second miracle, some consider it the first real plague, is that the Nile River turns to blood. But then everybody in Egypt does not drop dead from lack of water. And so later, when Moses tells the frogs to all go back, they're told to go back into the Nile. And in fact, that's exactly what he tells Pharaoh, that the frogs will be constrained one more time to the Nile. Well, if all the fish and everybody in the Nile died when the Nile became blood, then saying there's going to be living creatures in the Nile is kind of pointless if the Nile's still blood. So we know that these plagues like the blood happened. They seem to have lasted for a period of time, and then because it is flowing water after all, that it would have washed into fresh water again. But that all takes time. That's my point. is that the plagues happened over the course of a long period of time. So this hardening of Pharaoh's heart was not a real quick affair. It was a long-term affair over the course of time and unbelievable circumstances. Now, one of the things that God was really, really clear about when he spoke to Moses at the burning bush was that he is the God that is. When Moses said, "Who should I say sent me?" He said, "You tell Pharaoh, I am sent you." God gave himself that proper name. I am that I am. We all know that phrase. In other words, I exist because I exist. And intrinsic in that statement is, every other God doesn't exist. I'm the God that is. I'm the God that does exist. I am. All the others am not, if you don't mind the bad grammar. All the other gods don't exist, and so God is going to pour out these plagues in succession that all correspond to particular Egyptian gods as well. God doing two things. One is showing that he is superior to all the Egyptian gods, and that whenever he wants to, he can mess with them. But secondly, in this succession of ever-worsening plagues, it's almost like God is taunting the Egyptians and saying, "So where are your gods? If your gods exist, why aren't they helping you? Why aren't they saving you?" This reminds me of Elijah dealing with the priests of Baal and taunting the priests of Baal. Have you ever read that? It's funny stuff. It's really funny because Elijah gets downright sarcastic. There's a point at which he actually says, as the priests of Baal are cutting themselves and shouting out, he says, "Well, maybe your God is busy. Maybe he's indisposed right now. Yell louder. Maybe that's why your God doesn't hear you." Well, I like that. That's sarcastic. I can enjoy that. But the whole idea is to mock those gods and say those gods are not gods. Because not only is our God going to prove himself as actually existing, but he's going to prove it in such a way that you're going to need your God's help and they're not going to be able to help you. When the priests of Baal were done, and God proved himself by sending fire down and soaking up the sacrifice that had been drenched in water. Do you remember the next thing Elijah did? He killed the priests of Baal. And where were their gods to stop Elijah from killing any of them? There was no help there. And so God's going to do that here to Egypt. Not only is he one by one going to start knocking off their gods, but he's also going to be taunting them like, "Where is your God to help now? You have all these gods that should be able to protect you at this moment. And yet I'm going to keep messing with you. I'm going to mess with your sacrifices. And I'm going to mess with your priests. And I'm going to do everything I have to do to show you that I am and no other God is." So we're going to talk a little bit of Egyptian history. We're going to talk a little Egyptian mythology tonight. And see how much of that we can tie in to the narrative starting in Exodus 7. Starting at verse 1. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'See, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet, and you shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh, that he let the sons of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt.'" We hit this 2 weeks ago, and I paused for a moment at that point and said, this is one of those stunning declarations in the Bible that if you just read past it, you'll miss the phenomenal depth of the statement. God saying, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart." This is something God is saying, "I will do. I will do this." From that point forward, the faithfulness of God to his own word is on display. If God does not harden Pharaoh's heart, then God has declared things that are not true. Once God says, "I will do this," it's an absolute, it's got to happen. I will harden Pharaoh's heart. So is Pharaoh going to have any choice in this matter?
Nope.
Is Pharaoh going to have a decision moment? Is he going to have an opportunity to will to make the God of Israel his Lord and Savior? He's going to have none of that. There's no altar call. There's nobody playing "Just As I Am" in the hope that maybe Pharaoh will come forward. There's none of that. All there is the absolute declaration, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. But why does God say he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart? He says he's going to do it for this reason. I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. God is absolutely determined to do some things that are going to be so cataclysmic, so earth-shattering, that 4,000 years later, we'll still be talking about it at a little church in Smyrna, Tennessee. We'll still be talking about what God did in Egypt, and that's God's intention. God's intention is to harden this man's heart, the very man that God has raised up to a throne of power and authority in Egypt. God is now, having positioned him exactly where he wants him, is going to harden his heart in such a way that God gets glory to himself. Now, one of the fundamental theological standards that I stomp on over and over again, declare over and over again, dig my feet in and say this is true over and over again, is that God saves particular people for his own glory. The salvation of men and women is all wrapped up in God's glorification of himself. God does what he does to glorify himself. And we love that truth. That's a wonderful, marvelous truth because it's all wrapped up in the grace and the love and the forgiveness of God, in the kindness and mercy of God, and God is glorifying himself in his glory and mercy and kindness in saving particular people. And in this declaration here, Moses is saying that the exact same grandness and sovereignty and holiness of God is demonstrated in the way that he is now going to harden Pharaoh's heart and pour out miserable judgment on particular people. He's going to say, Israel, my people. Israel, he's going to call them my son, my firstborn, my people. And starting from like the fourth plague forward, every time he pours out a plague on Egypt, he's going to keep that plague from hitting the Israelites who are in the land of Goshen, safely tucked away. And so God is going to do things like make lice recognize geography. That's interesting. He's going to make lice like dust all over Egypt, and yet they don't go into Goshen. Quite miraculous. And the reason he's going to give for the fact that the lice don't go after the Israelites is he's going to say, because those are my people. So then I asked the question 2 weeks ago, how did Israel become God's people? Because that's a really good nomenclature, my people.
Because God chose them.
Because God chose them. That's how they became my people. So this theology that we teach all the time about a God who picks and chooses and who saves his own and who is willing to show his wrath and punish who he will, all of that Romans 8, 9, 10 theology that makes people so nervous is all the way back here in Genesis as soon as God goes to Abraham, who is the son of an idol maker, who is an idol worshiper in Ur of the Chaldees, as soon as he walks up to him and says, you're mine, and I'm going to give you a land, and your descendants are going to be as numerous as the sand of the sea, as the stars of the heaven, and through you, through your posterity, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. Why him? Because God chose. Yeah, to God's glory. There's no other explanation for it. And ever since the Bible began, ever since God started talking to people, ever since God started revealing himself to humans, the way he has revealed himself is as a God who picks and chooses. And that once he chooses you, you're his. Now the Israelites at this moment, who he's going to protect, who he's going to bless, who he's going to deliver, who he's going to take to a land that is flowing with milk and honey, the promised land that he told Abraham he was going to bring the descendants to. When he meets the Israelites after 400 years of slavery, are they full of faith toward God? No. Are they ready to follow the deliverer? Hey, here comes the man of God. Here comes Moses. God remembers us. Here he comes. Come on, follow the man of God.
No.
None of that. They object. They argue. They fight with Moses. And they are going to be such a thorn in Moses' side for 40 years that there's going to be times when Moses is going to go to God and say, okay, that's it, I can't do this anymore. I've had it with these people. So then is God reacting to Israel, his people, because they're such good people?
No.
Because they're faithful people?
Nope.
Then why is he treating them so good?
Because
they're his. And how did they become his? He chose them. See, this theology just continues and continues and continues. Now, the great security in that theology is you can look at Israel's rebellion. You can look at their state after 400 years of being in Egypt. They even long for their Egyptian gods. Later, while Moses is up on Mount Sinai getting the law, they're downstairs dancing naked around a golden calf. These are not God-fearers. These are not people who are going, yes, follow Jehovah. They're still chasing after their Egyptian ways and culture, and they're going to complain every time they get hungry and say, oh, we miss the sweet onions and the leeks that we used to eat in Egypt. Remember back then when we had plenty to eat? They're glorifying their slavery days. Remember those days when we were slaves? Those were good days, weren't they? Because at least our bellies had food occasionally. These are not faithful people. These are not people that are seeking God. These are not people that have a heart for God and His plan and His will. And yet, God is going to keep every promise He makes to them because they're His people, because He's faithful to every promise He ever speaks, and they became His people because He chose them and elected them, and therefore He calls them Jacob, my son, Israel, my elect, my firstborn, the kindest language that he can speak of any human being. Wouldn't you love to know that somewhere in print that a prophet somewhere said, by the way, God spoke of you, Rick, and called you his son, his firstborn. You'd be like, yes, I am so good. Score. Everything about your life from that point forward would improve. No matter what went wrong in your life, you'd go, but God said, I'm his son, I'm his firstborn. I got that going for me. So even if everything else comes apart, you know, I'm in with God, I'm all right. Well, that's the great beauty of the new covenant, is then we read that if you have that Holy Spirit of God implanted in you, which produces faith in the finished work of Christ, then you are in fact his elect. And if you are his elect, he has loved you with an everlasting love, and therefore he called you to himself and proved it by writing your name down in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world. And so whenever I read that God is faithful to Israel, I read in that, and he's going to be faithful to me. Because Israel didn't even have the Holy Spirit indwelling them and giving them the faith in the finished work of Christ that we have. They didn't have the fullness of the revelation that we have. They didn't have 5,000 years of God's consistent, faithful activity in human history like we have. They didn't have any of those advantages, and they were rebellious, as we're going to see over and over again. And yet God keeps his own word to himself because God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself. And when he saves his own, he's glorifying himself. And when he judges his enemies, he's glorifying himself. It's all about God. It's all about God's glory. And so he can make statements like, I will harden Pharaoh's heart that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. It is God's intention to pour out plagues. When Pharaoh will not listen to you, see that phrase? When Pharaoh does not listen to you, not if Pharaoh does not listen to you, then I'll do some things. When Pharaoh does not listen to you, I'm going to do these things. That's how sure God is that Pharaoh is not going to listen to Moses. Now, he's going to send Moses, and he's going to tell Moses what to say, and he's told Moses, Pharaoh's not going to listen to you, and he's also said, and when he doesn't listen to you, then I'm going to punish him. That's a very, very sovereign God. See, the sovereignty of God extends far beyond just, like I said, those parts of Reformed theology that we love so much. The grace of God in salvation, we love that stuff. Election to life, oh, I love that stuff. And those are the places where we usually emphasize God is sovereign. Sovereign grace. But in this passage, we're really seeing sovereign judgment. And it's just as sovereign. It's the exact same God. Which is why Paul could write in Romans that God is willing to show his wrath, but is long-suffering toward the vessels fitted for destruction, so that he can show his glory on those vessels that he created for glory. And so there are, consistently, in the economy of God, those people that are his people, who will become trophies of his grace through all eternity, so he can say, look what I did. And there have always been those that he just plain didn't save. And they're going to fall under his hand of judgment, because we all know that in the end, hell is real, and hell is eternal, and hell is God's ultimate judgment, and people do go there, and the answer to why they go there is God didn't save them. But he's been like that ever since Eden. Very consistent God. And when Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. See that? His judgments are all part of his glory. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. Isn't that remarkable? I would understand it. I would comprehend that verse if it said, and then Israel will know that I am God when I bring them out by a mighty hand. I go, yes. By the time they're passing through the Red Sea, Israel should be going, yes, this is our God and he's on our side. But that's not what he said. He said, then the Egyptians will know that I am God when I bring my people out. God wants universally to be declared as God, but will their knowledge that that God exists and that he conquered them and that he overthrew all their gods and that he brought all these judgments and that he delivered his people, will any of that lead to their eternal salvation?
Nope.
No. Apparently not. No, they're going to fall under his hand of judgment. At least they do throughout this story. In fact, the army is going to all end up on the bottom of the Red Sea. And God's going to plan it exactly that way. And then he says, and the Egyptians will know that I'm God when I do all that. Because God universally is going to be recognized as God. The New Testament parallel is, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God, the Father. Every knee is going to bow. Every tongue is going to confess of things in the earth, the passage says, of things on the earth, of things below the earth. Every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess. You know, when Jesus was walking on the planet and he came across the demoniac of the Gadarenes, do you remember the first thing that he did, the one that's called Legion? Do you remember what he did? Fell down and worshiped and called him Son of God. He said, what are you doing here? We're the ones that are supposed to be down here on earth. What are you doing here? Have you come to essentially torture us before the time? They know. They know their judgment's coming and they know who's going to bring the judgment. It's him. And now here they are. They found a host. There's a legion of them living inside this poor fella, and the Son of God shows up. And they know enough to worship him. Demons know enough to worship him. Every devil in hell knows God exists. No atheists in hell. No agnostics in hell. They all know God exists, and they know that he's the one that sent them there. It's only humans. Silly, foolish, egocentric humans who refuse to bow the knee to that God. And all the angels in heaven do it. Every devil in hell does it. It's only those humans, those self-willed, fleshly humans that just refuse to bow the knee and walk around saying things like, I will not have this man to rule over me. I'm going to do the things I want to do the way I want to do them whenever I want to do it. That's the way humans are. And yet, the Bible declares, every knee is going to bow. Which says to me, either you're going to bow willingly, that's the good way, that's the way you want to do it, go with the willing, but you're going to do it either way. And so when you read in the book of Revelation about Christ coming back and smashing nations like potsherds, that kind of language, both in the Old and New Testament, I can imagine him coming back and breaking legs until everybody gets down in front of him. But that's consistent with the God we're going to see here. I'm going to do all these judgments, which are going to be absolutely horrific. I'm going to do my best to try to describe these in a way that makes you downright queasy, because I want you to try to walk in Egyptian shoe leather for a few moments and imagine what it must have been like for these people. It was horrible for these people to have to live through. And yet God said, I'm doing this so that the Egyptians will know that I'm the Lord. So they're going to know he's the Lord, but that's not going to result in him being gracious, merciful, kind to them. It's going to result in him getting glory to himself through his own righteous, holy judgment. Got all that? That clock back there, by the way, is the one that I usually go by, and the battery doesn't work, so it says it's 10 to 12.
Here, I got it.
No, you don't got nothing. No.
I got 8 hours.
Yeah, I got time. This is all introduction. No, I have a watch on. Oh, dear, is it really that late? Oh, man, I got to get going. You know, there's the old joke about the preacher who got up in the pulpit. There's the two little boys sitting in the front row, and the preacher took his watch off and laid it on the front of the pulpit. One of the boys turned to the other and said, what does that mean when he does that? And the other boy said, apparently nothing. So I've laid my watch right there. But as long as we're here at this particular juncture, and as long as we're thinking along these terms, God getting glory for himself through salvation, through kindness and grace, and also getting glory for himself through judgment, if you can conceive of that God, the biblical God, then it will also help you arrange your thinking in such a way that you will avoid one of the biggest mistakes running through modern evangelicalism. And that is an incorrect definition of who God is. Arthur W. Pink many years ago wrote a really good book on the attributes of God. That was the book that really helped me get my thinking straight about the subject of God and his primary attribute. In most churches today, if you talk about God and his attributes, the attribute that they will put right at the top of the list is love. They'll say, God is love. And they'll say that is his primary attribute, and therefore, since it is his primary attribute, all of his other attributes flow through that primary attribute of love. And so then they'll talk about the good and loving God who does good and loving things, but they'll only list the good and loving things God does, because those are the only ones that fit into a paradigm where God is primarily love. Everybody following me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Biblically, God's primary attribute is not love. It's holiness. His primary attribute is that he is a holy God. And the way that you can determine, even through the use of language, the way that you can determine a primary attribute is just use it as the primary adjective to describe his activities. Because we have no problem saying, God demonstrated his loving grace. Well, that's great. That works great. God demonstrates his loving kindness in salvation. Great, got it. But what about these passages we're reading here, where God says, exactly, my loving judgment, my loving plagues. I'm going to pour out my loving death of the firstborn of everybody in Egypt in love, because I love you.
My loving wrath.
My loving wrath. I'm going to send people to hell eternally, where there's outer darkness and weeping and gnashing of teeth, because I am love, and I love them so much. See, that gets real confusing real fast, because you have taken one characteristic, one attribute of God, and you've lifted it up above all his other attributes and defined him by that attribute. But we have no problem, biblically speaking and lexically speaking, we have no problem talking about God's holy love, holy kindness, mercy, holy grace, and equally talking about his holy judgment, his holy wrath, because God's attribute of holiness can actually be the impetus behind everything God does. His love can't be, but his holiness can be. Yes, ma'am?
Could it not be that our definition of love lacks? Because holiness and love and all those attributes are not incompatible. They have to be in agreement. So somehow the wrath fits the love definition. I think sometimes we want to make a romantic ideal out of love rather than see love for what it really is. Somehow
right.
The wrath fits. Somehow the punishment and consequence of hell fits into love.
Yeah, most languages have multiple different words for love. English is limited to just that word. So you're right. We have romanticized love and given it a very narrow definition. And then the sad part is then they take that very narrow romantic, humanized version of love. And when they read God is love, that's what they think it means. But, right, the love of God is that sacrificial love that does for the one being loved. You've heard me define this over and over. Does for the one being loved what is most beneficial to the one being loved, even if the one being loved doesn't want it, isn't looking for it, doesn't know they need it. But sacrificially, the one doing the loving does it anyway for them. But I think it is a little bit confusing to say, well, then His holiness and love, which are very compatible, but to say that somehow His wrath and His love remain compatible because they're both offshoots of His holiness, I think it's a little confusing. Let me put it to you this way. I love my kids. I love my son in a way that I don't love Linton. I love Linton. Great kid. The couple of times I've met him so far, the kid is aces, okay? I like the kid. But right now, right in front of his dad, I just said that I don't love Linton as much as I love James. And Len did not leap out of his seat and come up here and go to fisticuffs with me because he understands that it's fair for me to discriminate in my love. And so can I say that I love James with a fatherly parental love and that I will always love James because he's my son and that I don't love, that I have no love that I can muster up anywhere in myself for Charles Manson, right? And is that fair? Because if I can discriminate to that degree, then God can. And I don't have to force some definition of love on my feelings for Charles Manson in order to make it compatible with my parental love for James. Nevertheless, the point here is to say that God is primarily love is to misdefine God. And by defining Him incorrectly, you get a lot of confusing theology. Because then you have to say, John 3:16 really says that God so loved the world, loved him so much, he just loved him, that he then said, that was Jeff, that was my impression of Jeff, by the way, I just did, which is why Jennifer enjoyed that so much. That God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And then you get to John 3:18 and it says that those that believe not are condemned already. And you go, so where's the so love in that? If they're condemned already for not believing, if he really so loved them, wouldn't he be giving them more chances, more opportunities, waiting for them? Wouldn't he be doing something? So confusion reigns as soon as you define God incorrectly. That's my point. To be theologically and biblically consistent, all you have to do is recognize that everything he does is motivated by his holiness and his glorification of himself. When people say, well, how could a loving God send people to hell? That's a big complaint against the notion of hell. People say, well, how could a loving God punish people eternally? Because they've misdefined God. A loving God can save particular people by his grace and bring them to live eternally in his presence, and that is phenomenally loving. But the same holy God can punish his enemies eternally and not in any way destroy any facet of who he is as a holy and a loving God. Right? Yes, sir.
All of God's characteristics of holiness, justice, love, grace, mercy, the holiness is the only one of his characteristics that is always present in every action and all things. Mm-hmm. That's how it's subordinate. Love, just like, again, I mean, I try to always act loving toward my family, but I don't always try to act loving toward people that I work with. But I always try to be just and
sure.
Right.
And, mm-hmm. And if you can discriminate that way,
Then God can.
Absolutely.
That is when the church puts love as that capital, it provides so much fodder to the enemies of the cross.
Absolutely.
I mean, because that, how many times, how can a loving God,
yeah.
That's always the start of every, right. How can you believe that a loving God can? So, well, I believe a holy God can.
Exactly, a holy God can. And so then when we say, we believe in a holy God, who chooses and elects from among
love.
Sinners. Yeah, that's why the people who believe that he's primarily love will say, well, your God's a monster. Yeah. Because they've misdefined that God.
True of all those things. Is that
yes.
When he is sitting on the throne and judging people for their sin, I mean, his primary motivator is not mercy.
No.
It's not love. It is holiness.
Holiness.
And justice.
Yep. And his glory.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. Don't talk out of turn.
I don't suppose there's any chance that the reason he hardened Pharaoh's heart was to show himself to the Egyptians so that some of them would be saved?
The only thing I can say to that is, if I was going to state that with any kind of certainty, I would have to have a text somewhere that says that, and it doesn't. All we know for sure is that he pours out misery and judgment on them, which he says he's going to do, and he keeps saying he's going to do it to deliver his people, and then identifies the Egyptians as simply not his people.
Well,
so it's a clear demarcation. Yes?
Would it not be, again, it might be a stretch, but you think of people like Rahab, you think of God-fearing people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a stretch to think that someone at some time came from Egypt and told someone, hey.
Actually, we will see, we won't get to it tonight. We're not going to get to anything tonight, but that's okay. Next week, we're not here, by the way. It's Halloween.
Reformation Day.
And it's Reformation Day. It
all
sure
Hallowed
is.
Eve.
It's All Hallowed Eve as well.
Charlie kept saying that in our omnibus class. He kept calling it Halloween. She kept saying Reformation Day. He goes, well, that's not quite the same thing.
Well, no, I would agree they're not the same thing. I mean,
But it is the same thing.
But they derive from each other, yes, yes. But Luther was not like up there nailing his 95 theses to the wall wearing a mask of Casper or something, you know.
And a bag waiting for some candy.
Trick or treat, Catholics!
You know, so. Wasn't Casper, was Darth Vader.
Exactly. Didn't happen. So I was going to say, yes, there is a text coming up that says even among the Egyptians, there are some that learn to fear God, who are even going to argue with Pharaoh, like, how long are you going to do this? So yes, among individuals, there might be some who wise up enough to say, you know, we need to fear this God, but there's no explicit text that says that they actually have any sort of spiritual awakening. Anybody with half a brain, after four or five of these plagues, is going to say, can we maybe not do this anymore and become fearful of the one who's bringing the plagues? That makes sense.
Let's do what the guy says.
I mean, he keeps coming in here, and bad stuff keeps happening. So, yes, was there another hand? Yeah.
One of the things that really helped me in thinking about God and his attributes, which goes along with what we're talking about here, is understanding this idea of holiness and what that means. And oftentimes we think of holy as meaning pure, and it certainly can have that connotation in the context if it's set in contrast to evil. But the primary idea there is separateness or otherliness.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember which writer it was. I read one time that described God as otherly.
Holy other.
And that's a great way to describe God. And that applies to all of his attributes, whether you're thinking about his righteousness, his justice, his love, his mercy, his grace, his vengeance, his wrath, you know, whatever. It's all otherly.
Mm-hmm.
It is so otherly, it's so different, it's so set apart and separate from us. That's why we struggle with it. When you see God acting in these scenarios like we're looking at now, you know, you just have to stop and pause and fear and tremble and say, you know, this is that otherly one that's doing as he pleases.
Yep.
As he pleases, he's in no hurry.
Yep.
He's not being hurried by the Egyptians where he gets impatient and decides to skip the second half of the plague,
right.
You know, to rush through. He's not hurried by the Israelites crying out in misery either.
Right. Because they suffer a bit through this too. Yeah.
You know, when he spoke to Abraham, he said this is going to happen way out there, hundreds of years from now, as you've reminded us. Again, all that just goes back to telling us how otherly God is compared to us and compared to modern-day renderings of God.
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime we want to get too close to thinking we're godly, all we got to do is bring about burning hail. Knock yourself out. When you do that, I'll think that you and God are equal. Till then, he's, as you described, other than we are. All right, let's try to make some progress here. When Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. Verse 5, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. When I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. So Moses and Aaron did it, as the Lord commanded them, thus they did. And Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron was 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. And that is exactly where we left off 2 weeks ago. Which means that was all introduction.
It doesn't count against
my time. So we're just getting started now. We have brownies. We're good. We can hang around.
There's water.
No. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Work a miracle,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent.'" So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did, just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a snake. Then Pharaoh also called for his wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, and the magicians of Egypt, did the same with their magical or secret arts. For each one threw down his staff and turned it into serpents, but Aaron's staff swallowed up all their staffs. So they ended up staffless, and Aaron's snake was superior over the other snakes. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said would happen. Now God already said he's not going to listen, and we're going to do the miracles first, and he's not going to listen. And then the miracles are going to get a little more progressive until they turn into plagues. He's not going to listen. And I am eventually going to kill all the firstborn. He even told Moses that back at the entry, at the very beginning of this whole thing. He said that he's going to kill the firstborn of Egypt. So there's no question about what's going to happen here. Now, there's a couple things that I could choose to pass over here, or we could take the time, but, oh, let's take the time. I really have nowhere to be. I'm a lonely guy with no social life. So, you know, if you got somewhere to be, just take off. I bought 200 CDs today, so I can just keep slamming CDs in here and just... Two things I want to talk about. One is Aaron's staff. You're going to hear a lot about Aaron's staff in the upcoming passages. You know that I am fond of finding and pointing out the Christological typology that continues to run all the way through the book of Genesis and Exodus. Aaron's staff is going to become one of those Christological types. In the book of Numbers, later on in Israel's history, as they're wandering in their 40 years in the wilderness, in the book of Numbers, I'm going to say chapter 17, I believe that's accurate, you can read about a rebellion in chapter 16. In fact, Barney, when he was here on Sunday, talked about Korah's rebellion, Korah and his whole family. 250 of them showed up at the door of the tabernacle and argued with Moses that Moses had taken on too much, that Moses was usurping too much authority to himself, and that they, being Levites and being also part of the family of Israel, God's chosen people, are even going to argue and say, aren't we also the chosen people? And so they're going to argue that they ought to have some leadership on their own. And so God's going to have them gather at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and that every one of them is to bring an incense censer in their hand, which is an offering to God, and they're going to come stand before the door. And while they're standing there at the door, God tells Moses to tell Aaron to go tell everybody else in the camp to get away from the tents and the houses of Korah and his whole family and his whole band. Just get away from them, clear out from them. God's going to judge them. And then Moses announces that the earth is going to open up and swallow Korah and his family and his men and his people. And the earth opens up, and it says that they went straight into the pit alive. Remarkable language. And then the earth closed up again. And it says that the Israelites are running for fear away from the crevice that opened up for fear that they would also fall in. That's a good reaction. I understand that completely. Meanwhile, God has these 250 rebellious men standing at the door of the tabernacle, and fire comes out of the tabernacle and burns them all. But then we were just talking about holiness, otherliness. The end of the chapter says that then a son of Aaron, part of the high priestly line, has to go out and collect the metal from the censers, because the censers with the incense had been brought to the door as an offering to God, and therefore they, which were lit with the fire of God in vengeance, are now holy and can't be touched by anybody common. And so a son of a high priest has to go out and collect the melted metal of the incense censers, and it's used to make a top, a lid, for one of the altars of sacrifice to remind Israel of the time that Korah and somebody else decided not to do it God's way, and they brought their own fire. Only a high priest can bring incense before God. And so there they are with their incense censers, thinking they should be priests too, and so God burned them all, but in the process sanctified the gift they brought. They're remarkable. Oh, you're dealing with a really, really holy God here. And so the point is, in the next chapter, in order to make clear to all of Israel which house of Levi has been chosen, Moses tells all 12 tribes, the leaders of each of the 12 tribes, to each bring their staff, their walking stick. The head of each of the 12 tribes is to bring their particular staff and write the name of their tribe on the stick. But then he says, on the tribe of Levi stick, use Aaron's staff, that whole Aaron staff thing, and then have Aaron write on it his name. Not Levi, it's the Levi stick, it's the staff that represents the tribe of Levi, but God says, write Aaron on it. And then leave those in the tabernacle overnight. And the next day they come back, you know the end of the story, and Aaron's rod sprang to life overnight. Didn't just spring to life, but has new buds on it and almonds. Turns out it was an almond branch he was carrying around all these years. So Aaron's rod buds. Now, if that had been the end of the story, that would have been fine. It's clear that God has chosen Aaron to be the high priest. This solidifies it. God even says, this will stop the arguing. I have chosen Aaron and his lineage to be my high priest. He's the only one that can come in here with incense. He's the only one that can sacrifice for Israel. He's my high priest. But then God does something remarkable and tells Moses to take that rod, Aaron's rod that budded, and put it in the Ark of the Covenant. Well, what else is in the Ark of the Covenant? The Ten Commandments and a golden cup with manna in it. Now let's think about those types for a moment. The first one, the Ten Commandments, is actually the second set of the Ten Commandments, despite what Steven Spielberg will tell you in Raiders of the Lost Ark. The first time Moses went up on the mountain, as I referenced earlier, he comes back down with tablets that specifically, it says, were cut out by the finger of God. God cut out the tablets, and God wrote on the tablets. These are the tablets of God made with God's hand. Moses comes down off the mountain, consistent personality profile, he loses his temper, and he throws them down onto the idol and breaks them. He goes back up onto the mountain and has to tell God, I broke your stuff. Yeah, you know, yeah. You remember those rules? Those weren't like important, were they? So God gives him a new commandment. God does not cut out new rocks with his own finger. He tells Moses, go hew out rocks, then I'll write on them. So now you're talking about a rock hewn with human hands, written with the finger of God, that has law of God contained in it. There's typology. And so God says, put that in this box, which we'll now call the ark or the carrying box of the covenant. And so inside that box is the law of God that has been cut with human hands, which is really interesting typology. The second thing is manna in a gold cup, which is a sign of perfection. And the manna, even Jesus identifies, I am the bread from heaven. He says, Moses didn't give you that bread. My Father gave you that bread, and I'm the bread from heaven. So we don't have a whole lot of problem identifying the manna in the gold cup as being a type of Christ. And then we've got this law that is the embodiment of the law of God cut out with human hands, more typology of Christ. Now we've got the sign of resurrection, Aaron's rod, the high priest's rod, that sprang to life, and God says, put it in with the other two. So you've got three things in there. One, if you say that the law on the tablets, if you want to say that's a type of God in his law, fair enough. And if you want to say the manna is clearly identified as Christ, fair enough. And if you want to say that the type of the rod that budded is the Holy Spirit, because it brings about resurrection power and life, fair enough. Then you've got the Trinity inside the box. But all three of them also typify Christ. And so, if that's true, then Aaron's rod that budded is the same rod being talked about back here when it keeps being identified very specifically by the same Moses who keeps calling it Aaron's rod. He wants you to know which rod we're talking about. It's Aaron's rod. And Aaron's rod is going to be used for these miracles, including it's Aaron's rod that's going to be held out over the Red Sea, that is going to part the Red Sea and deliver God's people and then bring the judgment on the Egyptians. That's all done with Aaron's rod, which later on is identified as a type of resurrection power in Christ. So I thought I'd knit all those pieces together for a moment so that you can see that all the way back here, Moses is already laying out, prefiguring, pre-shadowing what he's going to tell you later about the specific rod that's called Aaron's rod. So Aaron's rod is the very rod that was thrown down that then became a snake that then ate up the other snakes. But every time you see this phrase, Aaron's rod, hold on to it. I didn't want to just go by it and miss it. I have two choices when you bump into something that big. I either have to leap forward to Numbers and connect the dots, or I have to wait till we get to Numbers and then reach backwards. So I just wanted to jump forward for a moment so that every time you see Aaron's rod, you realize we're talking about the same one. And in fact, later, God is going to quit calling it Aaron's rod and just call it the rod. Like Moses would just know which rod. The rod. And that rod is a type of Christ, all the way back here being used to do the miracles that deliver God's people. Christological typology is throughout the Bible. See, the point is, I'm going to let you go, but the point is, I really only have one message. And that message is, it's all Christ. It's Christ from beginning to end. It's the beginning of Genesis. In the beginning, God made the heaven and earth. And according to the beginning of the Gospel of John, it was Christ who spoke the words, "Let there be light." It's all Christ. And so as we continue to read through these Old Testament books, we keep looking for that thread, that golden thread that connects every word of Scripture. It all keeps leading us back to the same story, which is God in Christ saves his people. And that's what's already happening here. God, using a typology of Christ, is delivering his people. It's the same message over and over and over. It's always the message of gracious deliverance for God's people through Christ by God's sovereignty. Same message. It just keeps getting said through a lot of different modalities. Now, in 2 weeks, if you'll remind me, we'll start right here with the snake-eating bit that we just read. Remind me, because in 2 weeks it'll be hard to remember. I'll have to go back and listen to myself say this so that I remember that I want to talk about this. The fact that you can duplicate something God does not eliminate the reality that God did it. You understand what I'm saying? God made animals. The Bible says that God created everything from nothing. So if you go see a magic show and a magician shows you an empty bag, and then pulls out an egg or a rabbit, just because he did that, that does not eliminate the reality that God made everything from nothing. Because one of the most common ways that people try to argue against the Bible is to try to find naturalistic explanations for the things that happen in the Bible. And then they think that if they can create some form of what God did, that that eliminates the idea that God did it. And that's what the magicians here are doing. First, God miraculously turns the rod into a serpent. And then to eliminate the idea that this is actually proof that God exists, Pharaoh has his magicians do a similar trick. And when the similar trick happens, everybody goes, "Oh, well, then it wasn't God." And that explanation exists to this day, that they continue to say, "Well, yes, you know, it wasn't really the Red Sea that parted. It turns out it was really the Sea of Reeds. And the Sea of Reeds, every spring is at low tide, and there are a lot of sandbars there. And when the low tide goes down, you could walk across the sandbar in about 4 inches of water, and that would have allowed the Israelites to part and walk across the Red Sea." which is how apparently he then drowned the Egyptian army in 4 inches of water. So there's still a miracle in there somewhere. But men think, you know, you watch the Learning Channel, the History Channel, and there'll be all these TV shows, you know, searching for the real Jesus, searching for the historic Jesus. And they're always looking for naturalistic explanations to explain away the miraculous elements of the Bible. But just because you can imitate something God has done, that doesn't eliminate the reality of what God did do. Understand my point? And that's why Aaron's snake ate the other snakes and then becomes a rod again. And so for the next couple of plagues that God brings on, Pharaoh's going to turn to the magicians and say, now you do it. And then they're going to do it.
Flaming hail, I dare you.
Yeah, exactly. But some of them actually become quite funny. When you have a plague of frogs, so thick that it's in their clothes and in their beds and in their cookware and in their ovens and they can't get away from it. Yeah, how do you know who's or who's? And how impressive is it to have a magician go, look, more frogs. Yeah, exactly. Well done, Potomac.
I don't think they had ovens back then. Though.
Actually, what they are pits that were dug where they could cook inside them, yeah. Or even stone, earthenware, and that kind of stuff. But in any case, the point is, you know, there were frogs everywhere. So eventually, the very fact that they can do these little tricks amounts to nothing. And even more frustratingly for them, if these magicians were really any good, they would eliminate the plagues. They wouldn't imitate them. They would go, okay, here come all the frogs. Hey, can you do that? Well, yes, I can make frogs, but if you want to be impressed, how about I make all the frogs go away? That would be impressive. None of them ever try that. Instead, they just imitate what God did to try to prove that what God did is not really God. But that is such typical human thinking, and it's still on the TV today. My point is very simple. There, I've said most of it. Now I don't have to repeat it in 2 weeks. But the idea is just because humans can create some vague, watered-down version of something God did, that does not eliminate the reality of the fact that God did it. You understand that? All right, well, we've hit an awful lot of material tonight, and we really didn't get very far into the text. We didn't even get to the first of the gods, but we'll get to all that. There's so much to say here, and really it's very fun. It's very, you'll pardon me saying it, it's really very entertaining. This entire story is so full of the sovereignty of God and the befuddlement and bewilderment of human beings and God just demonstrating himself as God. So we'll pick it up in 2 weeks after we get past Reformation Halloween Eve Day. Okay? All right. Any questions before we say goodbye to the internet folk? All right, good. Say goodbye to the internet folk.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. And there they go.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.